Hello, everyone. My name is Joanne Lockwood, and I'm your host for the Inclusion Bites podcast. In this series, I've interviewed a number of amazing people and simply had a conversation around the subject of inclusion, belonging, and generally making the world a better place for everyone to thrive. If you'd like to join me in the future, then please do drop me a line to joe.lockwood@cchangehappen.co.uk. SWChangeHappen.co.uk. You can catch up on all of the previous shows on iTunes, Spotify, and the usual places. So plug in your headphones, grab a decaf, and let's get going. Today is episode 101 with the title Beyond Labels. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Vanessa Rath. Vanessa is a talent sourcing trainer. And when I asked Vanessa to describe her superpower, she said her ADHD. Hello, Vanessa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Joe, good to be on your show. Thanks so much for inviting me to be here. 101 guest. I feel like I should be thinking about Dalmatians, because as soon as you said 101, I just thought Dalmatians and dogs.
Why not? I mean, obviously, we steer away from you being Cruella. We'll stick to the Dalmatians themselves.
No, it's an absolute honor. I can't believe you've done 101 episodes. That's amazing. Well done, you.
I know. I've enjoyed every one of them, and it's fascinating to meet guests such as yourself and have a great chat and get to know people. And this is we've been looking to catch up for some while, so this is an ideal opportunity. So thank you.
Excellent.
Vanessa, beyond labels, what does that mean to you?
So for me, I think that it goes beyond just saying beyond labels. I've always had a thing about people judging others. And I think when you judge someone, you give them a label. And that for me is just so frustrating, is that we do it. I think it's human nature. You know, you see someone walking down the street and, you know, you give them a label straight away. Maybe it's a gentleman with lots of tattoos and you immediately think rough, you know, maybe from the wrong side of the street. Meanwhile, these days he's probably like a top CEO or MD. You know, it's about those snap decisions that we make when we look at people and we give them a label. And it's completely unfounded. It's just based on, you know, our point of reference. Where are we coming from? And probably from something that inherently has been built into us, you know, through the course of our lives. So for me, from my perspective and being a talent sourcing trainer, beyond labels is giving everyone an equal opportunity. You know, don't look at a CV and just label someone. Don't look at someone on LinkedIn only and give them a label of they're a perfect candidate if you haven't, you know, cross-referenced them across the internet. You might find something else that's even really good that you can sell them to be a culture fit into the organization. Or you might find something that makes you think, well, this isn't actually going to work in this role. So it's about doing your homework before just willy-nilly applying labels to individuals.
I mean, obviously, I work in the EDI space. You're an experienced person who works in the talent sourcing space. So we talk about this kind of things all the time. But the average person in corporate South Africa, corporate UK, corporate America, wherever you happen to be, doesn't always think about this, do they? Their focus is on empty seat. I need someone to fill that slot. I want someone to hit the ground running. Mike has just left. I want another person just like Mike.
Yeah.
How do we move people into that way of thinking?
Absolutely, 100%. And I think that what happens is, and this is why, like, I'm a little bit stuck with company referral systems, because what happens is, you know, Mark leaves. Mark is a white male. We must get another white male because Mark was great and we're all going to really miss Mark around here. Or you then have someone who looks like Mark who's left behind and he recommends his friend who looks and sounds and speaks like Mark because that's what was there previously. So it's all about it's our point of references of what we think will work best. And it is a massive problem. It really and truly is. I mean, you've done 101 episodes on this. We all know that more diverse organizations and staffing teams perform better, make more money, are more enjoyable workplaces for people. And from a, you know, my perspective of, I have the unique, I don't want to even say it was a privilege, but the unique view of growing up in a apartheid South Africa, we didn't have opportunities to mix with people from other races. So in the workplace was where I got to meet people and actually form friends with people from other racial groups. And I'm eternally grateful for that because it afforded me the opportunity. I went to a school where only white children were allowed to attend up until I was in my final year. So I think it's something that we definitely need to do in the workplace because we can.
Hmm. There's often I perceive there to be a kind of often a disconnect between the motivation in a workplace and the motivation in society. So if you work for a large organization, a corporate, you've got DEI, you've got HR people, you've got people in talent sourcing, all focusing on equal opportunity, equity, ensuring people succeed. Whereas you step out onto the pavement, society doesn't always care about you as an individual in the same way. And we often think that a company culture is a microcosm of the societal culture. But sometimes companies are actually leading the way in this.
They definitely are, 100%. But then we have the extreme case in a country like South Africa, you know, where I'm based, where, you know, businesses are mandated to go and hire people from different racial groups because the government puts stipulations in place on them. So sometimes you find it's always happening, but it's a false kind of view of what they're trying to achieve, which is good. We need to do this. You know, however, it needs to be done for the right reasons. So ED&I is something that's hugely important, has to be a focus, but it has to be done with the whole company's buy-in, because society is kind of left to their own devices. There's no one really trying to be the CEO of a society. But, you know, if it's coming from the CEO of a business and they are all over the, you know, they're on the ED&I bus, brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you talked about labels. You talked about stereotyping people. And we, as a species, we're quite judgmental, aren't we?
It's just awful.
We're evaluating people all the time, going, oh, yeah, shoes, watch, hair, car, nose, glasses, whatever it may be. And putting people into our little stereotype box and say, I know who you are now because I've sussed you. And we do that in hiring as well.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And it's really something that's quite difficult not to do. I mean, no one's perfect. I mean, I do it. I catch myself doing it. I've just actually had knee surgery. So I've spent a lot of time while, you know, all the guests have been here over Christmas, sitting on a bench, you know, at the beach while others have been playing on the beach or walking or swimming. And, you know, you sit there and you look at people and I find myself judging people as they're walking past me. And I'm like, who am I? You know, why am I doing this? I don't have to be doing this. And then often, you know, I'd be left with all the old grannies who also have the bad knees and couldn't walk on the beach. And then you find out that even though this person's old, I mean, they're in their 80s, they're amazing. I had the most wonderful conversations with old ladies who were pretty much, you know, their knees were about as good as mine. And they were just the most interesting, lovely people. But when they sat down next to me, I was like, no, but you shouldn't feel like that. You know, they were wonderful.
Yeah, I can't believe how it happened, but I checked my diary and I'm 60 next year. But in my head, I'm still 25. I'm still a young adult with young adult thoughts, just with knees that don't work. That's the only thing that's different, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we also, you know, we're talking about labels. We also, you know, sometimes label ourselves incorrectly. And our perception of what we're putting out there and what people are seeing is often two completely different things. And I just think that there's a bit of a disconnect there of what we think we are putting out into the universe and what people are, how they're reading that, you know, are they getting a different label to what we're trying to give ourselves?
Yeah. I mean, I could see how it evolved. You know, you think about prehistoric human back in the times where we were living in small communities, small tribes, and anybody who came from over the hill or across the water was inherently bad, because why were they coming? Probably to rape, pillage, attack, steal, or whatever.
Yep.
They weren't coming to say, knock on the door and say, do you want to buy something or anything like that, or be nice. So we've evolved this sense of protectionism where the judgment is evaluating the threat level, isn't it? You know, adrenaline glands, our vagus nerve, our fight, flight, or freeze mechanism are kicking in all the time, linked all to our biases, which is why people who are different to ourselves and not in our in-group are seen as maybe as threats or as less effective than we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's the whole thing of, you know, who are you going to? So you walk into a conference venue and there's a whole lot of people attending a conference. Who are you going to naturally gravitate towards? And again, there's people who look and sound like you. And I consciously try not to do that and go to groups of people that don't look and sound like me, because, again, I think this is a throwback from growing up in apartheid South Africa. I want to know more about different people. I know what people like me do for fun on the weekends, but I want to make friends from other racial groups because I'm really interested in, you know, their lives and how they grew up and those kind of things. So, yeah, you're right. It's where do we hang out with the labels that we like, or do we go and look for people with other labels? That's
the
question.
So this is talk about, you know, how you grew up. So you probably grew up in the F.W. de Klerk era, the pre-Mandela, the apartheid, the sanctions era where South Africa weren't allowed to compete in sport, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. So how did that effectively influence you as a person, but also influence those around you? It was very ingrained. Apartheid was very ingrained in the culture, wasn't it? In the white culture, sorry.
It is. And look, I do believe that it's getting better. I mean, if I look at my son who's 18 and, you know, godchildren and things like that, they all mix interracial groups and they have friends from different racial groups at school, which I think is completely amazing. But Nelson Mandela actually got voted into power in my final year at school. That was in 1994. And up until then, we were only white children in my school. So I never got to mix with people from different racial groups, which was very sad. So, I mean, the knock-on impact of that was that we were kept very segregated, and it was just awful. But when you're growing up in that kind of setup, you don't know that it's any different. I mean, I remember an instance when I was in the town where we lived, and I was out with my nanny, who was a black lady, Maria. She basically, raised us. And there was a toilet. And so I'll give away my age here. I'm 47 now. So this must have been in 1986. I must have been about 10. And there were two toilets, public toilets, in the middle of the town. And there was one for white people, and there was one for non-white people. And I remember the maid, my maid helper, Maria, saying to a white lady who was going into the toilet, saying, "Can I send this child into the toilet with you? Because we both need to go to the toilet, but we have to go to separate ones." And they were almost like a block apart. And that was a major thing that stuck with me. And I just thought it was, now in hindsight, as an adult, you know, talking all around the world about DNA, that's how strange that was. But back then, I didn't even question it because that was the way it was. Very strange.
Yeah, I mean, from a UK perspective, I probably more aware of the US culture around racism, you know, the Hidden Figures film about the segregation of toilets, the Rosa Parks story, the Southern American narrative. I suppose I didn't get to hear much about the South African perspective because there was this apartheid. Apartheid's bad. So we didn't really dive any deeper into the culture of what was going on. So my experience of racial discrimination is probably US American focused with a bit of UK focused.
Which is really interesting because I remember back in just before I started my own business in 2018, I went and did a keynote for SourceCon in Seattle. And I spoke about my journey growing up in apartheid South Africa. The talk was very much around a DE&R focus. And how many US citizens came up to me and said, "Thank you. Thank you for standing up on stage and calling a spade, pretty much, and talking about racial issues, because it's something that is not spoken about in the US. And that's actually out of anything besides, you know, as doing a keynote at such a big forum. What stayed with me from that up until this day was the reaction. I mean, I was talking, and the whole time I was talking, I thought, here I am, I'm like bombing this talk, because people were crying, they were reaching for the tissues. And I thought, I'm just going to keep going with this. And the reaction was due to what I was talking about and explaining what it was like and how they need to get their, you know, ED&I in place for the right reasons, you know, and don't let it become as bad as it got in South Africa with apartheid.
Yeah. I mean, as an outsider, one of the things I perceive as a difference is South Africa is being minority ruled by white people in a black country, whereas America is kind of ruled, there's no clear majority. You know, if you look at the Hispanic population, Spanish-speaking, black population, and the white population, it's white-dominated, but it's not a black society, where South Africa was originally a black society that was colonized and taken over by the Dutch, the British, and all the Northern European colonizers, if you like.
Absolutely. And it was even a gender thing. I mean, there were no females sitting making these decisions in the minority. It was all literally white males that were, you know, the president, his cabinet. Very few, very, very little female representation in that. So, like, for example, South Africa was one of the first countries to legalize gay marriage because, you know, that was never a thing for us. We still try to get over the whole racial, you know, the fallout, the hangover from apartheid.
So that was your big elephant in the room was resolving racial
Absolutely.
Tensions and differences. As you say, the other EDI, gender, yeah, sexuality, et cetera, they were kind of a lower priority, probably non-existent because everyone was so focused, yes, on race, isn't it?
100%. Absolutely. Where now those factors are coming more into play. I mean, there's a massive drive around, you know, gender-based violence, GBV, and things like that, and to really highlight them and to just, should I say, try and do away with, you know, how some of the women are treated in the more rural areas of South Africa.
And is that across racial demographic? So it's not, yes, a white problem, yeah, or a black problem. It's a problem. It's a male
problem. It's a problem. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a male anger problem.
Yeah. I'm not looking to excuse it, but is it born out of frustration? Is it just socialization? I mean,
sure. I think it's got a whole lot of factors. But so let's look back and see what South Africa did during COVID. So we were one of the few countries that actually banned alcohol sales. So while everyone was sitting in lockdown, the rest of the world was in lockdown, there was a ban here even on smoking. So you couldn't buy cigarettes in South Africa during lockdown, which wasn't a problem for us. But they banned alcohol sales. And the reason why they did that was there's a big drinking culture in South Africa, which often resulted in a lot of poor behavior on Friday and Saturday nights. And the, you know, casualty rooms would be full after domestic violence. And then that took away from us trying to deal with a massive pandemic of COVID. So they banned alcohol sales, trying to keep the population under control. So you can see that would be one of the effects of, you know, the gender-based violence in this country. It would be the alcohol consumption.
I remember seeing on the streets, because Australia was pretty locked down as well, but you were pretty locked down. So you had armed guards, yep, on street corners, and you effectively locked in your homes for a lot of time, weren't you? And I remember seeing the stories on it. Has society flipped back? Has it just carried on where it left off? Or is a reduction in the culture of alcohol?
Sure, that's a good question. I wouldn't like to speak on behalf of the whole country, to be honest with you, Joe. Us personally, we actually drink a lot less since COVID, because I think we realized that we didn't really need to be drinking as much as what we were. And it was never like we had a problem, but, you know, maybe it wasn't as bad as what people made out. I mean, we had very entrepreneurial, innovative South Africans making pineapple beer in their bathtubs, you know, just trying things out.
Fantastic, yeah. You can distill and you can brew anything, I guess, if you've got the right
exactly.
Banned alcohol, but not yeast. Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So yeast sales went through the roof in supermarkets.
Well, that's the human evolution, human culture, as you say, the entrepreneurial spirit coming out.
So, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I guess people were making their own tobacco as well, or
derivatives. No, we were importing cigarettes illegally from Mozambique, I believe.
Right. to quote Jurassic Park, nature finds a way, you know, humans will find a way as well. You know, it's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where there's a vacuum, you fill it.
So true.
So you say your superpower is your ADHD. Is that something that you've realized you had with you all your life, or is it something you've grown to embrace and value, or is it held you back at all in your life that you're now realizing it?
So I was pretty much first diagnosed in high school and didn't talk about it openly. You know, just a bit of a stigma around it. And then I actually went to study teaching. That's my formal qualification. I'm a middle school teacher and loved that, and found with that kind of profession, I didn't need to be medicated for it. But I'll never forget, I taught in London for 7 years, and sitting in the staff room in Southfields, and the special needs teacher came to me and said, "You do realize how bad your ADHD is?" And I said, "What?" And I hadn't even told her that I had it. So she had picked it up just by watching my behaviors and all of those things. And she said, you know, so she pointed it out. Then it kind of came back onto my radar as an adult. I didn't do anything about it, because then I went off traveling the world for 2 years. And, you know, when you're working as a scuba diving instructor, you don't need to be medicated for ADHD. Then I came back to South Africa and ended up in an office environment working in a recruitment agency. And I realized then that actually I needed to go back onto medication. So I did, and I started talking a little bit more about it. But it's only literally in the last, since I started my own business, which is 5 years ago, that I have, my previous employer where I was for 10 years knew about it, because it actually counted towards a BEE stat here, that, you know, I could get some kind of a point for the company towards whatever levels they were getting for the government. But so they knew about it, but I didn't talk about it. And then when I started my own business, I thought, actually, you know, I'm doing well, standing on stages all over the world. Maybe it's time to talk about it, because it's not a, you know, there shouldn't be a stigma around having this. And I did, and promptly discovered that, you know, at least 2/3 of the international sourcing community suffer from ADHD too. You know, everyone seems to, you know, have that. And I think that the reason why I refer to it as my superpower is because I think people who have ADHD don't have as many, should I say, inhibitions as other people. And we're quite confident and we're quite happy to go and talk to people. And that definitely has helped me to be stronger in the recruiting space. So it's something that I'm now comfortable to talk about and take medication for it every day. And I've just had 3 weeks holiday here in South Africa because it's our lovely summer. And I must admit, yesterday when I started work, I was quite ready to get back onto my Ritalin, because I only take it when I work, and get some focus and sort out my very busy brain. And but it was good to give it a break.
So you mentioned there's one of the things that you see as a as an asset in your entrepreneurial, your business, is the ability to just go and talk to people, to be out there.
Mm.
What would you say would be the harder parts of, you know, running? Obviously, you're running a business. What's the hardest bit around your ADHD, if you like, if you weren't on meds, or if you, even if you are on meds? Because I appreciate meds also, they kind of numb you a bit, don't they? They take the tops and the bottoms off. And this.
No, my medication doesn't do that, to be honest. My medication actually just allows me to concentrate and focus. So I don't feel like it doesn't have anything to do with my emotions or moods. Thankfully, I'm very stable. I like to think, maybe it's also my husband, around my moods and, you know, those kind of, I'm not a moody person. It just helps me to concentrate. So the most difficult thing, Joe, to be honest with you, is getting the admin done. You know, it's when I've got people who finished my academy and now they need a certificate, but that's admin. It's boring. It's not thinking out of the box. It's not being creative. That kind of stuff is difficult. Being a solopreneur, I choose to be a solopreneur. I don't want to have a team around me, but I've still got to get the admin done, right? Someone's got to sit down and pay the bills and, you know, do all of those things. And that's what I find really difficult.
So it's the routine, the mundane, yes, the thing that doesn't trigger with you with excitement. Yeah.
No.
I get that.
And then I leave it to last, and then it's often too late. And it's, you know, it's,
yeah,
it's,
I want to relate a lot to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So that's the difficulty.
So I often wonder who is this mysterious neurotypical person, because I wouldn't say I have ADHD, but I would say that I think in my way, and I resonate with what you've just said. I resonate with what other people say, and so I do wonder what is neurotypical. And I also wonder, you know, going back to prehistoric human, what were the attributes that were most valuable in prehistoric human? I mean, and I think a lot of the attributes of people with ADHD would have been really valuable in a world where you had to kind of be alert and deal with stuff.
Yeah. So let's go back to what we started talking about, was labels. So, I mean, if I say to someone I've got ADHD, they immediately think, you know, I'm going to be bouncing off the walls and I'm not going to be able to sit at my desk and, you know, all of those things, which to a certain degree, you know, would be true. But people, that's what they immediately think. But actually, ADHD manifests itself completely differently in males versus females. So, you know, you can't just look at someone and put a label on them and say, oh, God, no, I can't have that person in an open plan office because they've got ADHD. They're never going to get any work done. It doesn't work like that, you know. And if you medicated for it, you know, does the person still need the label?
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
You know, so... Yeah, it's an interesting space. And I think now that I feel safe that I'm running my own business, I'm not letting a company down when I speak about it very openly, because it needs to be spoken about. I think sometimes that people jump too quickly to a diagnosis of ADHD. Like I chat to, you know, my friends, and they often contact me and say, you know, Van, my son's just been diagnosed with ADHD and put them on medication. Can you talk to my son? And I'm like, well, no, not really, because, you know, it's completely different and it manifests in different ways. And I don't know that medication that he's on, and I don't know what he's going through. It's so different in each individual. Very subjective.
And I think the way we started this podcast, where you see it as your superpower and you're able to embrace it. There's no shame. There's no stigma.
No.
It's part of you. It makes you who you are. And you, as a mature adult, that sounds really crass, isn't it? Mature adult. I want to be a mature adult.
I want to be a child.
Yeah, no. I'm nearly 60. I'm older than you. You told me when you were born. I think when you get to that level of maturity, or you age, you start to own who you are and not see these things as threats or challenges. They're just you work with the tools you got.
Yeah, I wonder if this resonates with any of the other ladies out there. You kind of hit 40 and you do a little bit of cleansing and you get rid of the friends that you maybe no longer need in your life. You do, you know, get rid of the energy vampires and you get really comfortable in your own skin and you a lot more selective of who you spend your time with, whose comments you let bother you. And I think it's a great place to be. It really is.
Yeah. And that's a certain sense of knowing who you are. Because once you know who you are, that contextualizes a lot around you, doesn't it? As you say, you can drift away from people who are like energy vampires. I love that. Mm. That's a great session. I mean, I've heard the expression, hang around with radiators, not drains. So you look at people to amplify you.
Yeah.
But I suppose before you reach that level of self-awareness, you don't realize what's going on in your life. You're not aware of the impact of that. You're reacting, you're diving in, you're still vulnerable in your identity, maybe.
And so, maybe 40
is that point.
Yeah, maybe. And then you talk about like labels. So I have to think about it. So we're here now and we've just finished the festive season and my son's 18 and I mean, he's out every night and he's, you know, partying and really enjoying it. And he's literally going out when I'm going to bed. Where 20 years ago, your label wanted to be, you know, look at you, and you're party animal and you're out there having so much fun. Now I've got no issues telling people that I like to be in bed by 8:30 because I do. But I'm up at 5. I was in the swimming pool before 6 o'clock this morning. You know, so it's your labels, and you know, will change, you know, and also your labels of other people will change because that's just life, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you say, is it 40? I mean, obviously I'm nearly 60, as I've mentioned. I hang around with a cohort of people who are similar age and we all agreed that 50 was fantastic.
Really? That's good to know.
And I'm also hanging out with people now who are going, 60 is where it's at, you know. I think
That's
every decade you grow into it and you look back and think, I think we just learn and grow throughout our lives. And probably when we were 30, I remember being 30, deciding that I was now getting old. I was no longer 20, I was no longer young. And I think maybe 30 was that barrier between adulthood and student. I had to do something in my life now. I couldn't say I'm getting there. I had to be somewhere.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's I agree. I think my 30th birthday was, I remember being like mortified, you know, just what is happening. I actually had a midlife crisis at 30 and I moved to live in Thailand. I lived in Thailand for a year because I didn't want to face being an adult and being in the real world.
The thing you don't realize when you're 25, and I'm going to pick 25 for a good reason, is you don't realize there is an end date to your life. 25, you've got 50
years. Invincible.
50 years is forever. It's twice what you've had already.
Yeah.
It's miles away. It's three times. You know, you're a third of the way through. Third, it's nothing. I turn 60 next year and I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I've got 15 years of productive life. I'm not saying I'm going to fall off the shelf or drop dead or anything. But when you get past 75, things stop working. Your brain doesn't want to do stuff. You want to be kind of sat on the sofa a bit more or doing your retirement activity. And I'm thinking, I've got to start thinking about, I've only got 15 years. And I started thinking, you know, being 50 was 10 years ago. So in 10 years' time, I'll be 70.
I know.
Jeez, that's not a lot left.
I read a very interesting study, and I can't even tell you where it was, but it was while I was on leave now, about how people over 70 actually lose the ability to be able to make decisions. So like even a small decision, you know, that's where other people around them, like their children, have to make those decisions for them. And having, you know, 2 years ago gone through where I had to become the adult with my parents and move them and sort out their new home and do everything and close off bills, and because they just didn't have that ability to make a decision anymore. It's a really interesting thing. And I see it more and more with the, you know, the generation, my aunts and uncles going through the same thing. It's almost like someone flicks a switch.
Yeah.
That's it. And it, for me, I'm very nervous about that.
I suppose when you're younger, you're making decisions for the rest of your life, which is a long way away. You've got a plan, a growth plan. When you get to your 70s, I guess you're making decisions for next week and for next month, not necessarily.
Or even would you like to go out for lunch or not? You know.
Yeah. So, what do you think? Shall we?
I don't know. What do you feel like doing? What do you feel like eating? Yeah. Having just had, you know, a couple of the older family members staying with us over Christmas, I definitely noticed that. Hard to make a decision.
Yeah. I mean, my father's in a nursing home at the moment and he's kind of happy enough there. Obviously he'd rather not be there. He'd rather be at home with my mum, but he's happy enough. And he's got a disconnect now between his perception of the world and his capability. So he says, why don't I just come home? You can put me in your car and we can do this. And we said, well, you can't get out of bed. You have to have three people get you into the wheelchair. How are we going to get you out of the wheelchair into the car? How are we going to get you out of the car into the... And it's like, and he says, I should be able to cope. And so that you lose this ability to recognize your own sense of self and capability. And I think maybe that's tied in with age as well, where you this disconnect occurs. And hopefully I've disconnected already.
No, you definitely haven't. But that's so interesting. I always am amazed at how many people in the UK, and of an age, and I'm saying our age, I know that we have got an age difference, but their parents are still alive. And it's so amazing. A lot of people our age in South Africa have lost parents or are losing parents now. People in the UK seem to live for a hell of a lot longer than in South Africa. So an aging population is a thing in South Africa, but not as much of a thing in the UK when you look at labeling and ED. And I was always amazed when I lived in London at these ladies who must have been, well into their 80s with their little shopping trolleys, getting on the bus and going off to Sainsbury's to do their own shopping. And that's, I think, what keeps a lot of the older generation in the UK going for a lot longer. We're South Africans, we have a lot of help, a lot of cheap labor, high employment level, unemployment levels. So there's someone that you could pay to do something for you. But in the UK, you keep acting longer.
Yeah, I suppose with my father's just turned 90. My wife Marie's father is 90-something. Marie lost her mum this year at the age of 89 and a bit. Mine is, 86 now. So you kind of think once you pass 90, that's a fair go. Well done.
Yeah. Good innings.
It's nothing to be ashamed of. If you're in your 80s, you'd expect people to start dying or losing people in the 80s. But before your 80s, in your 70s, you think, that was a bit young. Or someone's in their 60s, late 60s.
Well, I lost my mom when she was 75, and I just feel that was just far too young, I agree with you.
Yeah. So I think if I'd like to get to my mid to late 80s, the same age as my mum.
Well, look at the genes that you're following. You got a good chance.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just got to lose some weight and stay healthy. That's the trouble.
But you're doing that. I mean, aren't you in the gym a lot?
I'm not in the gym enough. I go once a week with the personal trainer, and I do work out. I mean, that case came down to a couple of years ago. I woke up and said to myself, "Hang on a minute, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of years." This was 2 or 3 years ago. I'm investing in marketing. I'm investing in this part of my business. I'm investing in that. I'm paying money on subscription for this and the other. And I realized the only person I wasn't investing in was me. And I'm kind of the critical part of my business. Without me, there is no business.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when I decided to give up alcohol. I haven't had a drink for two years. I think 2 years today since my last drink.
Wow. Geez, well, amazing. And what prompted that? Was that just from a health perspective?
It was all this thinking about becoming 60 and thinking, if I want to get to 75, and I use that date as my work till I'm 75, because I feel I have to, I don't have a massive pension or security. Mm-hmm. So I work till I'm 75. And then if I want to be able to stand up and work and think and do stuff at 75, mm-hmm. I can't wait until I'm 70 to think about that. I actually have to think about that before I'm 60. So if I'm drinking too much, not eating the right stuff, not active enough, then the time to do that is now, not kick the ball down the road and say, when I'm 10 years' time, I'll figure that out. Because by then, my knees won't work, my hips won't work, I'll pick up diabetes, something's going to happen to me. Yeah. So I decided to take personal responsibility to invest in myself as the core part of my business if I'm spending money on marketing. So I need to spend more money on me than I do on marketing. That's kind of the argument. Yeah. So
it's very valid. It's actually, I haven't thought of it like that, to be honest, Joe. This morning, actually, before we started recording this podcast, because we just moved town, we went to the local gym and signed up for the gym because it's January. We now live by the beach, and I also need to drop a couple of kilograms, to be honest, to feel more comfortable in my clothes, kind of thing. I mean, I think my days of being on a runway in Milan are over, but just to feel healthier. And I just think that becomes important as you get older, where, again, as you're younger and you're 25 and you're bulletproof and invincible, you almost take that health for granted, right?
Yeah, it was that epiphany, wake-up call. And I'm not an evangelist. I'm not out there. I don't run. I tried running and my knees can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. I could do a treadmill. I can walk. I also decided I wanted to do something I really enjoyed. I don't want going to the gym to be something I can't be bothered. I don't want to do it. Yeah. So I have a personal trainer, and she's amazing. And I've changed gyms a couple of times in the last couple of years. So this latest gym I joined, and it's with my new personal trainer. When we had our briefing chat, I said to her, I want to come here and I want to have a laugh and I want to enjoy this. I want to go away happy knackered is kind of what I said.
Yes.
To her.
Yes.
I want you to work me until I'm literally can't do any more. And I want to leave with a big grin on my face going, yay, I've achieved something today.
Yes.
Yep. And that's kind of how we do it. We have a bit of banter. We have a bit of kind of jokey stuff. I give her the eyes, I give her the look when she's asking me to do something. I go, seriously? Really? Okay, come on then.
Yeah.
So it's entertaining. And I have an hour with her working out, killing myself as much as I can for me. I don't do it for her. I do it for me every time. But I come out and I give her a high five and go, thank you. I really enjoyed that. And that's excellent. Really what I want to look forward to.
Yeah, no, it's different. So me, I'm kind of forced back into a gym because running was my thing. But, you know, having had knee surgery in December, I've got a good 6 months before I can get out running successfully. So for now, it's going to be swimming in a pool at the gym. So, yeah, let's see how that goes.
That's great. No, I had a problem with my shoulder. I think it was called a rotator cuff injury on my shoulder.
So I couldn't move my
arm up and things like that. But I was getting up to 2 kilometers in the pool. So I was doing,
it was
a 20-meter pool. So I was doing a 100 length of a 20-meter pool. And I was going several times a week. So I was doing at least a kilometer and a half. And I peaked at 2 kilometers. And then my shoulder kicked in and hurt. Wow. I stopped going. I haven't been for about 18
months.
And
what were the physical benefits of you swimming more frequently?
I did lose weight. And I know people say you don't do exercise to lose weight.
Yeah.
But I think it's part of a package deal.
But you feel better.
Yeah. You feel better. You feel more energy. You're more active. Your persona grows. You've got more going on in your head. You know, they're sluggish. I think all of those kind of benefits kick in. And cumulatively, I was losing weight because I was controlling my intake, I cut out alcohol, and being more active. Those kind of come together. You know, you can't eat like crazy and do the gym and expect to lose weight. You have to do both. You have to cut the intake, increase the output.
Stopping alcohol is a massive factor in weight loss.
Yeah, it's empty calories. You're basically drinking a roast dinner. You're drinking a lunch.
Yeah, yeah.
And for wine is like, I don't know, it's 1,000 calories in a bottle of wine. That's half your calorie intake on a day just in one bottle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're serious about it, you can either drink it or you can eat it, and you can't do both.
So hence the saying that came up, you know, as we were young females as students, is, you know, eating is cheating because, you know, you'd rather use your calories on the wine as opposed to having a meal.
Yeah. And I see lots of studies and people talking about whether calorie counting is a thing and you don't lose weight that way. But I think an appreciation of the nutritional value of what you're consuming is important, and whether that's calories, whether it's fat, whether it's sugars, whatever it may be, just kind of getting a more understanding of what's going in your mouth, where it's coming from, how processed is it, the value of it, you know, salt. Yeah, so I think it's being more aware.
I mean, my anniversary coming up, you know, your anniversary today on the 24th of this month is that I would have been vegetarian for 4 years. And that literally wasn't a conscious decision. It was literally, you know, we had been away for, I mean, this is our big summer holiday in South Africa. We'd eaten, had so many bras or barbecues. I was all meated out and just said, my husband and I driving back from holiday, just said to each other, you know, let's just try a week without a piece of chop, a boerewors, steak, ribs, you know, whatever it might be. And that week has now evolved into 4 years, and neither of us will go back to eating meat. And we feel, you know, a whole lot better about ourselves and feel better. And yeah, you know, so as you say, it's about being more conscious of what you put in your mouth and where that actually comes from.
I'm certainly not a dedicated meat eater. I eat meat, and because it's a habit, it's what's in front of me, and it's convenient.
Yeah.
If I was at a vegetarian or vegan restaurant, I'd be perfectly happy. And often I will order vegetarian dishes as a starter or a main in a restaurant because I think, oh, that sounds interesting. Let's give that a go.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of these people that says, oh, it's got to have meat in it. So could I give up meat? I don't know. I don't know if I could give it up, but I could certainly minimize it. I don't have to have a bacon sandwich, but I'd probably like it. I'd have to have an egg.
can you imagine the look on, you know, South Africans' faces when you go to a braai, which we pretty much, when you get invited to someone's house in South Africa, it's going to be a barbecue or a braai, whatever you call it. And you say, well, we're vegetarian, so we'll bring our own mushrooms or corn or, you know, whatever we're putting on the braai. It's quite a thing for other people to get their heads around as opposed to us, because we're just used to it.
Yeah. And if I turn up with you and say, well, we don't drink, it's like, okay, yeah. So we've got vegetarians and non-drinkers.
It could be our last place out together.
Yeah. But that winds us right back to the beginning of the conversation around judgment and labels. And that bleeds through into the, you know, think about workplace culture, where we're hiring people who fit into our culture. And suddenly Vanessa and her husband aren't part of our culture because they want to cook mushrooms on the grill. It's like,
well, exactly. So, I mean, for example, in South Africa, a big thing on a Friday afternoon, you know, maybe once a week or once a month, is to do a big barbecue. So our traditional sausage over here is called a boerewors, and it's got a whole lot of things inside. You don't really want to know what you're eating. I will admit they are delicious. But that was what happened on a Friday afternoon. And then, you know, I would go along to that and it would be like, I'll just have a dry bread roll because, you know, I don't have boerewors, you know, I don't eat meat. And they would be like, what? We didn't even cater for the, you know, the vegetarians. And we're not vegan. So, you know, if you're not going to have eggs, you're normally vegan. We eat eggs still. But it's kind of like, no one accounts for that. If I'm speaking at a conference in South Africa or whatever, I'll always state up front, or I'm delivering training, you know, I know you're probably going to order lunch. Just want to let you know up front I'm vegetarian, because people just don't think along those lines. That's just like, it's a label that being vegetarian is a label that doesn't go very strongly in the South African white culture.
Yeah. And being vegan has a stigma about it. It's like, vegan, you're going to bore me. You're going to, you're going to be hard work. You're going to be one of those people that wants to tell me how you don't eat meat. It's a judgment.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's also, you know, imagine someone who's a vegan, does CrossFit and has their MBA. I mean, you'll know about those in your opening greeting with them, you know.
and that is the joke, isn't it? How do you know someone's vegan? Because they'll tell you about it. Yeah,
they'll tell you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and we only help people when we're going there for dinner, or they've invited us over, because it can be awkward. I mean, I remember arriving in Sydney, going to dinner at a school friend's house, and hadn't thought to say up ahead, you know, I'm now, since I've known you, I'm now a vegetarian. And they made this most amazing like lamb roast. Mm-hmm. And I was like, sorry.
But just that joke we just made around someone who's vegan, and you know, that trope that we just, you know, they'll tell you about it. It shows that we belittle someone's identity, something that matters to people in everyday humor. And veganism is no less protected, as far as I'm concerned, as a right to exist than any other protected characteristic. And we'd be horrified at people using humor to describe in a racial or a gender or another thing. But there are some topics like veganism, like vegetarianism, like not drinking, that are seen as kind of a, it makes you less than. You're labeled, you're stereotyped, you're not part of our culture, you don't fit into our society. And it's easy done. Those judgments just keep rearing their head.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. And I just think that we've got to be so careful, you know, forming those opinions, because once you've kind of formed that opinion and given that person that label, it's actually very difficult for you to change that label in your head. And I think that that's something that's, I don't know how we're going to get better at it, but besides not labeling people, which as we've discussed is human nature, but not being so forceful with our labels too early on in a relationship with someone, you have to give someone a chance, you know?
Yeah. Or I think what I just did there was I kind of called it out after we did it. So I recognized actually that wasn't a great conversation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't respectful. Mm-hmm. It's playing on a stereotype, playing with judgment, playing on a trope, and belittling somebody because of who they are. So it's recognizing that you're doing it. Either catch it before it comes out your mouth, or if it does come out your mouth. That's the priority, I guess. But if it comes out, reflect on it and go, actually, that wasn't right. I shouldn't have said that. I need to own that. And I think that's the next best thing, right? Or if someone else catches you listening to their perspective and say, oh, all right, I see what you're saying there now, and acknowledge it.
Yeah.
So we can all do that. Judgment is so ingrained in us. It's hard not to. And if we can all have that kind of pause, slow down, filter, where we can start to process this stuff, it allows us to then think differently about people and challenge ourselves.
But agreed, I completely agree. But it's quite funny that you say that, because I obviously, you know, been sitting on the couch a bit with having my knee operated on. I caught Netflix's putting Ricky Gervais, you know, one of his comedies. Oh my word, I was sitting there cringing. But he actually, every single like snippet or skit of what he was putting out there in that hour was taking fun out of a minority group. I actually couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I saw a film of probably 4 or 5 years ago that Ricky Gervais he starred in. I don't know if he wrote it or not, but it's the only film that I've wanted to walk out, literally walk out of the cinema in the first 5-10 minutes. I was angry to the point where I can't watch it. I'm going.
What film was it?
I can't remember. He was playing guitar, and there was a lady in a gypsy dress by a tree. I can't remember what it's called now, but he was on tour doing something it was so many discriminatory tropes, stereotypes, mm-hmm. probably around gender identity, probably around homophobic type comments. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was just made me so uncomfortable. And when people say, well, he's edgy, well, I don't want people to be edgy in that way in my presence. I don't need people to be that kind of edgy. It's not clever. It's just insulting people or belittling people.
But that kind of behavior almost makes that judging and labeling mainstream now, because look, it's on Netflix, has done a show about it, and you know, famous person is now on stage performing, taking, you know, giving people labels and turning it into a joke.
Yeah, but then if you step back and say, well, other people have the right to enjoy that. And who becomes the thought police? Who becomes the D&I police? Who becomes the gatekeeper of civility? And in a broad church with lots of opinions, you're not the only person who's right. There are many rights, 100%. Many opinions, many perspectives. I mean, you look at what's going on.
Carry on.
In the political climates around the world, if you are left-leaning, you can't believe how people could ever vote for a right-leaning politician and what they stand for. Yet a lot of these politicians may not, you know, they're certainly getting 40% of the vote, 50% of the vote. So it's not a minority view. It's just not your view. And it's really hard to sometimes rationalize Absolutely. Other people's opinions when they're so abhorrent to you.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, I'm still amazed that Brexit happened. Like, I never would have thought in 100 years that the vote would have gone that way. That still amazes me. But there were obviously a lot of people, and I know it's a very contentious issue, that, you know, that's the way that they feel.
They were disenfranchised. The politics at the time were talking to people in the language that riled them, you know, about immigration, about taking back control, around these EU time wasters and money wasters and bureaucracy. We know how to do it best. We're British. We know best. Mm. We've survived as an island for decades and centuries and a millennia. And it plays into those. And the trouble is, what it created this two-tier where people who were Remainers perceived themselves as intelligent and clever. And anybody who was for leaving was therefore stupid or misinformed or being lied to. And how could you fall for that? So it really kind of created this divide, this real divide there, where there was a demonization and people who were remaining going, well, you're just soft and you don't want to listen. So both sides really believe they're right, and they still do. And it's important to reconcile, like any political difference, that I think even now it's 49-51. It maybe has swung more back towards the wish we had in the left, but there's still a large percent of the population who are ingrained in the fact we did the right thing. Yep. And you kind of have to respect that. It sounds crazy. I mean, we look across the pond to America about what could happen in the election this year.
That Trump could maybe get back in.
But then you have to recognize if Trump gets back in, it's because 51% of the population believe in him. So my opinion is therefore a minority opinion. And the fact that I don't agree with what he stands for or what his politics are, but a lot of the people in that country do. So you have to respect that. That's their right to vote. It's not, I just have a commentary as an outsider.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's about trying to rationalize those differences as well, isn't it? Those perspectives.
Exactly. So yeah, I don't know. Humans are complex beasts, aren't we? You know, It's just so true.
Yeah, I know. That's why I got out of IT. IT either worked or didn't work. You know, push the button, reboot it. If it doesn't work, buy a new one, put it in, it'll work. Humans, you can't reboot, no. Push the button. It's no.
Sometimes you wish you could, right? But, you know, we can't. Could. Yeah.
No, we'll just wave the magic wand. Just do as I say. I'm right.
Exactly.
And I think one thing that I've learned as a DEI professional is knowing that you don't have to be right. You're not right.
Mm-hmm.
Starting from that position of challenge and be open to changing perspectives is a core thing. And I think if we all did that, we'd avoid the judgment. Sport.
Yeah, exactly. Completely agree, Joe.
Well, Vanessa, it's been fantastic. I mean, we've been chatting to each other for an hour and a half now, half an hour in the green room, and I know you have to rush off. And so it's been amazing talking to you. How do people
thank
get hold
you
of
so
you?
Much. Joe, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having me as a guest. I was actually just thinking during this conversation, we still are yet to meet in person, which is amazing because we have spoken so much online. It's unbelievable. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Joe, I'm not difficult to find online is what I always say. My website is vanessarath.com. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Anywhere that you're comfortable with, just reach out to me. I'm always happy to chat.
And Rath is R-A-A-T-H.
Thank you,
Joe.
For
those who don't speak with a South African accent.
And Vanessa is V-A, single N,
V-A,
double S-A. Yeah.
Fantastic. I'll put all your contact details in the show notes and people make contact on LinkedIn or track you down somewhere.
Awesome.
So thank you. Thank you to you, the listener, for getting this far, for tuning in and staying with us. Hope you've enjoyed this conversation. If you have and you're not already subscribed or following this podcast, then please do tick the button. Follow us, and if you've loved listening to this, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you can. We'd love to hear from that. And this is episode 101, and I'm sure I've got at least 99 more to take us to 200 over the next year to 18 months. So please tune in. And if you'd like to be a guest yourself, you've seen the conversation, you listen to the conversation, you can listen to back episodes, get a feel for the conversation. It's open to anybody who wants to give their perspective on making the world a better place so that people can thrive. Any suggestions, feedback, please email me to joe.lockwood@cchangehappen.co.uk. And finally, my name is Joanne Lockwood, and it's been an absolute pleasure to host this podcast for you today. Catch you next time. Bye.